Hey, everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. I'm proud to welcome a brand new sponsor to the podcast, the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Their MFA in film offers a two-year student design project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and hybrid and transmedia projects. Exciting, affordable, and intense, refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories and an independent practice. Visit vcfa.edu/film for more information. Now I'll get back to them in just a little bit, but first, let's get on with this episode of the podcast.
Who are you?
I'm no one.
I was raised to do one thing, but I've got nothing to fight for.
Nothing will stand in our way. I will finish what you started.
There are stories about what happened.
Well, naturally, that clip was from Star Wars The Force Awakens. I kind of just had to do it. This is the big week, right? It's one of a few films I'm going to highlight over the course of this episode, because as we wind down the last days of the year, regardless of the fact that here in New York City, it's been extremely warm, if not mild, and doesn't feel at all like it's winter or New Year's time, whatever. Anyway, there are some films that need to be seen before the end of the year. And, of course, nothing can top the Star Wars movie. The only reason I haven't seen it so far is because, well, I have to go with my kid. And we have to find the right screening to go to, but I just haven't had an opportunity to go with him yet. And I can't go without him. That's the personal contract that I have with him. We're going together. Like my dad took me when the first Star Wars came out in the 70s. My dad and I went to see it together. And that's the same thing that we're going to do. Now, the only difference is that Jacob, my son, has seen all the other six Star Wars, on Blu-ray or DVD, what have you, at home. So he's never been to the theater to see a Star Wars movie. So we're both really geeked about that. There are a couple of other titles that we're going to talk about over the course of the show that are at the top of my list, one of which I have seen, which I referred to, which is the new Tarantino film. But there's a couple of others, including the new Spike Lee film. And I'm going to want to just chat for a few seconds about all of those films. On the show today is Henry Rollins. First of all, let me just say he is in a new film. It's called He Never Died, and it's about a guy who, he's immortal, let's put it that way. He will not die, as the title suggests. He's been around forever, and he will be around forever, and it's essentially a horror comedy, and he is definitely in just about every scene. And it was interesting because I ran into him at South by Southwest this past March, and I didn't know he was there with a film. I just saw him in a cafe, and I approached him because I just thought maybe, you know, somebody like that will be interested in coming on the podcast if I connect successfully with him. I don't know. I never know. And, you know, he looked me over and kind of, I'm sure he gets approached all the time. So he said very politely, you know, you should talk to that woman over there. And I did. And I gave her my card. And Nothing came of it. But then the film, he was there with the film. I didn't know it. But now, I found that out. And it's now coming out this Friday in New York City and a bunch of other cities around the country. In New York City, it'll be at the Village East Cinemas. And we're going to talk in great detail about the film, his character Jack, and other things like his writing and his growing up in Washington and becoming and being part of the punk scene there, which was a very seminal time. And I'm very excited. He was really an ideal guest of a podcast. So Henry Rollins. And then after that, my friends Denari Braxton and Takeshi Fukunaga, they are co-creators of a film called Out of My Hand. I did a TV spot with them a few weeks ago, and we had a great time. So we decided to do it again, only this time for the podcast. Their film, which is a quasi-neorealist type of film, in other words, it's about this farm worker or field worker in Africa who decides, because of how difficult the struggle is financially and just, you know, that he's going to, and to take proper care of his family, he's going to move to the States, where he has a cousin working in New York City, get a job here, and, you know, of course, send his money back home. And that's what he does. So the first half of the film takes place in Liberia, where there is a recent violent history, and where he himself has some blood on his hands, as we learn over the course of the film. And the second part takes place in New York City, where he does eventually go and gets a job driving a taxi. So we're going to talk about the film and the bigger news, which is that the film got picked up by Ava DuVernay's new distribution company. It's called Array, and it is the first film that they are picking up. So they recently did a theatrical here in New York City at the IFC Center, and it's now in the thrust of they're doing one-offs here and there around with the film. And I'm interested in following it because for those who listen to this podcast regularly, you know that I'm interested in filmmakers and distribution companies that go about getting their film out in unconventional ways, trying and experimenting with new methods and processes of getting the film out. And so we will have on Denari Braxton and Takeshi Fukunaga in just a little bit. But first, I want to play a short conversation that I had. Kind of coincidentally, it's also an African story. This is a short. It's called The Testimony. It was made by a filmmaker named Vanessa Block concerning something called the Minova trial, which was a rape trial in the Republic of Congo, where it was a result of government militia who raped many women in this village and the subsequent trial. And we're going to have Vanessa on to talk a little bit about that. The short was also noteworthy because it's been shortlisted for getting an Oscar, and so I was kind of curious. And also, I've been giving a lot of short shrift to short filmmakers. So we're going to have a brief conversation with Vanessa, and then we will go into my conversation with Henry Rollins. Okay, so back to Vermont College of Fine Arts, my new sponsor. Thank you very much, Vermont College of Fine Arts, for coming on as a sponsor. The first thing I did when I was approached by them is I looked at the faculty there, and I'll tell you something, folks. It's pretty impressive. They have got a great group of people on board. Laura Colella, who I met, Nina Davenport, who I know, documentary filmmaker, Josephine Decker. We know Josephine. She's been on the show a couple of times. Also among the faculty are Terrence Nance, who's been on the show a couple of times, Terrence Nance, and Till Schauder, who has been on this show. So there's quite a few people. So I thought this is a natural. I should be definitely partnering up with this film program. So let me just tell you a little bit more before we get into the show. The Vermont College of Fine Art MFA in Film offers a 2-year student design project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and transmedia projects. Each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings, workshop, lectures, and crits, along with preparation of an independent study plan of your personal projects. Then, students and faculty return home to work independently and meet monthly via Skype as projects unfold. The MFA program is designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. Exciting, affordable, and intense. Refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories in an independent practice. Again, visit vcfa.edu/film to find out more about the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Again, thank you guys for sponsoring a number of episodes that are coming up on the podcast. Here's my conversation with the filmmaker Vanessa Block.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing, Vanessa?
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Congratulations on your short, The Testimony, for being shortlisted for an Oscar. Do you know how many shorts are on the list for consideration?
Yeah, it's a list of 10 films, and then from this point to the next, it will be narrowed down to 5 for the nomination.
Oh, okay. Well, I watched it, and I would certainly not be terribly shocked if you are indeed nominated, so we'll just cross our fingers. It's a pretty intense documentary short. Tell me where the short premiered.
The short actually has not had its premiere yet, so we sort of flipped the traditional order of doing a season of festivals and then wrapping that up with a submission to the Academy. We finished the film in August, so timing-wise, it just worked out to submit first, and now we're just beginning to go out to festivals. So we're in a kind of our nascent stage of development at this point.
I see. Okay. So is there a different criteria then for shorts? Because, you know, with a feature, right, you have to, I mean, historically, you would have to have had a week theatrical in New York and or in L.A. I'm not sure if it, I guess you submit to what, the
Academy, we did a qualifying theatrical run in Los Angeles. So the film was shown in the theater for a week. I believe it was a week. Yes. And then following that, we went through the process of submitting the form.
Was the film matched with anything else? Because it's a half hour.
Yeah, no, it had its own slot. I mean, it's sort of the same schedule at any theater. It ran, and then another film ran, and then another. So there was no need to kind of match it directly. Oh. They were just all...
They were kind of alternating in or
right.
Yeah.
Right.
And rotating, I guess. And what was the reaction like? What was the reaction to this?
Well, actually, very few people, I think, saw it in the theater. The more of the views have come just from, we've done a few kind of, you know, smaller screenings just at homes and whatnot. And then obviously, you know, some people have seen the film just by sending them, you know, a private link. And the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. People seem to be very enlightened, shocked, moved, so the film has really been received extremely well. We couldn't be happier.
Mm.
And people are really starting to talk about the issue, which is what motivated the making of it to begin with.
Right, yeah. Well, it operates on a number of different levels, the film. I mean, certainly, I would say the human rights on a very basic level, the right to live a safe existence, for one thing, just a basic thing we take here in the States, more or less, most of us anyway, take for granted. But yeah, so the film takes place in the Congo, where government soldiers were raping hundreds of women with impunity, correct?
That's right. I mean, this particular event that kind of serves as the trial for the Minova rape serves as the backbone for the film.
Yeah.
And the Minova rape itself was an event in which government soldiers retreated to Minova, a village, and raped hundreds of their own civilians as a result of being pushed out of the city of Goma by the M23 rebellion. So this was a Congolese crime and a horrific act that you know, sent shockwaves to the international community and led to, you know, members of the community demanding that these people be held accountable for their actions. So that prompted the trial, and then obviously the film explores the way in which that trial was conducted, which is yet another additional layer of surprise and shock with how poorly it was handled.
Oh, yeah. It's a devastating thing to see. It's just sort of all the more incredible and astonishing that you got to shoot it and that that people sort of just are so used to, again, behaving with impunity that they're just nonplussed, you know, by these types of things. So it brings on tons of questions. First of all, you interviewed a number of the victims or survivors of the rapes. And I don't know how you get access to that. Like that. I mean, some of the people in the trial were cloaked, so they would remain anonymous, but these women spoke very freely and right to the camera.
Yeah, I mean, winning the trust of the subjects of the film was a very involved process, just in first accessing these women in parts of eastern Congo that were so far off the beaten path. So initially the process began with seeking out, you know, villages and places where we might be able to film. And then, you know, there was always the question of whether or not we would be able to successfully conduct any interviews there, because you know, there's so many constantly moving parts to the process. And it began with winning the trust of kind of the community leader. And then once they felt comfortable with our presence, I then, you know, sought out specific women who were willing to open up. And then from that point, sat down with them and through the translator, began to ask some questions and see, you know, who seems comfortable enough to really give a full interview. But it was a real process and challenge, because these women have, you know, many of them had never even seen Westerners before, and you come into a village mm-hmm. looking very different and bringing gear with you that looks almost like military, you know, weaponry. So there are a number of barriers to have to overcome, and it takes time and
right.
patience and all. So.
Yeah, I was wondering if you maybe just spend some time with the community just first, kind of hanging out, and just
yes.
so they could see that, you know, you were not a threat in any way. And
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there was no, you know, pulling out cameras upon arrival. It really mm-hmm. was a very delicate process, as it should be. You know,
of
you're a guest in there yeah. in their home, and you're kind of, you know, you're obviously, just by being a Westerner, it carries, you know, its own, you know, sordid history. So you're trying to overcome that and make people feel comfortable with your presence, and that takes time.
Two aspects of the interviews themselves. One is some of the women are really describing horrific events that they suffered or witnessed, and they kind of spoke with a certain amount of they just sort of were somewhat matter of fact about it. I'm not implying anything, actually. I'm really not. And on the other side of it, I'm wondering how it was for you.
Right. I mean, it was. I think actually the lack of theatrics and just the very calm and collected
and sentimentality
way in which
yeah.
they relayed this, yeah, it just reflects mm-hmm. so much about how commonplace this has become. And
Jesus.
It's not a surprise when events like these happen. It's expected. And that really, you know, kind of symbolizes the problem. And,
yeah.
and I think sheds a lot more light on it than perhaps if the interviews had gone a different direction.
Right. Oh, that's all the more devastating to hear.
Yeah.
And for you, I don't know your background, so I don't know how much. I mean, obviously you went in there very prepared, but I don't know if you're in the filmmaking in the past, or if you've done work, human rights work or anything, or if you were prepared emotionally or otherwise for.
I think I don't know that anything can totally prepare you emotionally for an experience like this. I think it was, you know, in so many ways, such a learning experience. I mean, I came into this with no background in filmmaking. This is my first film.
Okay.
And I also shot the film, so there was, you know, the technical hurdles to kind of overcome, obviously the emotional ones in conducting interviews with a topic that's so heavy and intimate. And so it was a learning experience all around. I mean, my background was I got my master's in international medicine, so I felt prepared to handle, you know, some of these issues kind of from that perspective.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing can prepare you. You can
no.
educate, you know, all you want, but when you're sitting down with someone who's experienced a travesty like this, you know, nothing can totally prepare you, I think, for that moment. But, you know, stripping everything away at the end of the day, you know, we were really just two women sitting and talking about something that affects so many women across the globe. So in many ways, there was a kind of a familiarity and a kinship in that that I think just sort of surpasses, you know, all of the other language barriers, cultural ones. We were just two women talking about something that's very important.
And then you no doubt now feel an obligation to the women, the folks in this town, to make sure the film speaks for them, and, you know, right, yeah, I can understand.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the number one priority from start to finish.
It's no doubt.
The reason why there are no, you know, Western talking heads in the film. I didn't want this film to be a commentary on rape in Congo. I wanted this film to be a testimony and provide these women who are so off the beaten path and would never be able to you know, gain access to have their stories told in such a public way. I wanted to give them a platform to speak about their experiences and what has happened, what can be improved upon. And the film is entirely in their native tongue and with subjects from Eastern Congo. So it really is, it's a film for these women.
Vanessa, why did you decide to make this a short as opposed to a feature?
I felt that when I was there, because I never found an ability to follow one particular subject for an extended period of time kind of through a process, which would have really endangered any of these subjects. So they took, you know, a risk in speaking with me, obviously, you know, opening up about something that carries such a stigma, and Congo has its own risk. So, you know, I was only able to take up so much of these women's time without creating a problem for them. So because of that, the form, it sort of took on an ensemble form that I felt was more well-suited for a short form as opposed to a long-form documentary. The trial itself then became kind of the, you know, unifying piece to the film. But I felt like, you know, I felt like the length was appropriate. I felt like, you know, things were delved into in an appropriate level of detail. I don't feel that this is a truncated version of, you know, a longer documentary that should have been made. I felt that the length was right. And it's also, you know, it's also will encourage people to really see the entire film. Sometimes it's hard to get people to commit to watching a feature, an hour and a half film, with a subject that's so heavy. So I didn't want to alienate any viewers also because of the length.
Yeah, I understand. In fact, yeah, Joshua Oppenheimer might be one of the few that have successfully gotten people to watch hour and a half plus long movies, documentaries about very difficult subjects. But I think it was I think a lot of films flesh out in truth, you know, and rather than really maybe figure out that sometimes short is, in fact, you know, the more appropriate length for their work. So it's great. And I have to admit to giving way too much short shrift to shorts on this show. And so I'm glad for the opportunity to talk to you.
Yes, me too. Absolutely.
Sorry I didn't see you in person, but we'll rectify that. In fact, you know, we should keep in touch so I can let people know how they can see the testimony. In the meantime, they can go to thetestimonyfilm.com, check out the trailer, and also get on your mailing list so they can find out how they can see the film ultimately, because I'm sure after hearing this conversation, you're going to have a lot of curious people, hopefully.
Absolutely. And also, the film will be available online in early 2016, so we're working towards getting it out there probably in about another month. So stay tuned for that as well.
Yeah. Well, no doubt not to be superstitious or anything, but of course a nomination could help that process along a little bit, not to say the least.
Absolutely.
But,
I mean, even the shortlist at this point has been an amazing platform, so we'll hope that you know, stability continues to increase and people will see it. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Vanessa Block, the director of The Testimony. It's produced by Steve Tisch, we'll mention, and Mitchell Block.
No relation, actually.
Oh,
everyone always thinks.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
This is an emergency. This is an emergency.
Homicides in Chicago, Illinois, have surpassed the death toll of American Special Forces in Iraq.
Hey, Ptolemaides.
Welcome to Chirac.
Chirac, where we at, my city.
Land of pain, misery, and strife.
Everybody here got a man banging and slanging, fighting for the flag, risking that long zip of the cadaver bag.
All to the bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
It all started with a gorgeous Nubian sister.
What's up, Spinner?
They call her Alyssa Strutt. A woman like no other.
You just try taking away their guns.
Okay, the dirty poppers.
Because my gun go boom, I'll make sure a Trojan end up in the next.
All right.
That, of course, is a clip from the new Spike Lee movie, Chirac. I can't wait. I didn't see it, but I'm seeing it this weekend, guys. And I'm sorry I haven't seen it yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to that. It sounds, from what I hear, that it's Spike Lee in his prime. You know, this is a filmmaker who gets a lot of criticism. He's held under the microscope quite a bit. I mean, you know, all of the most controversial and exciting filmmakers often are. And so if their work isn't accessible enough or as easily digestible enough, or they're scrutinized and they're criticized quite a bit. And I think Spike Lee is definitely one of those filmmakers. You know, God forbid he should make a work that, you know, only has a small audience that's going to really love it. Well, it's his prerogative to do so. But this is maybe a film that just hits right at the right moment and is connecting with a lot of people. Certainly critically, the film has gotten a lot of great reviews. I haven't read any bad reviews about it yet. And so I'm personally looking forward to it. Maybe I'll do so and talk about it at the first possible opportunity. So that's that one. Okay. Actor, musician, author, personality. Henry Rollins.
Maybe you should join us for a ride.
Oh, shit!
Get out of my house.
How are you doing today, Jack?
We need to talk.
Do you have anything aside from being ambiguous and hostile?
Hi.
Hello? Who's Andrea?
You never mentioned a daughter.
We just met a few hours ago.
So what do you want to do today?
Bingo.
I 20.
You're kind of out there, aren't you?
Get out!
I'm going to, thank you, man.
No problem.
It's such a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
I've been following you and your career forever, and I think we're roughly around the same age, too.
28.
Exactly. Happy birthday, by the way. If that was an option, speaking of a timelessness, because this is a topic of the film
sure.
as well. But, I mean, somebody said 28.
You know,
would you do it?
I've thought about that idea quite a bit. And, you know, as we all do, you sit on an airplane and, you know, 80 million ideas go through your mind as you go to Europe or wherever. You have so much time to think. And so I think to myself, okay, pretend, like, just walking around this neighborhood, which is all sleek, youngish people. And you're
Yeah.
Wow, I remember when I kind of was like that. However, it's 2015, and if I was 28, or just pick any number, you know, any age in your 20s, the thing that I think about is, what would my musical context be? What shows could I have not seen if I'm 28 now? What would be bands? And it always comes down to music. What bands would be relevant to me? Like, when I was 15, what would have been my band?
Mm-hmm.
And I keep coming back to, I'm one lucky bastard for being born and raised where and when and how I was. I saw Led Zeppelin. I saw the Cramps when they used to play in clubs.
Mm-hmm.
I got sweated on by the Ramones. I stood in front of the Clash. I saw the Bad Brains, like one of their earliest shows, like this far from them. I saw the first ever Minor Threat show. These are all like, you know, D.C.
There was a big, yeah, I was going to say, you grew up in D.C.
Yeah.
And there was a big punk scene there, right?
Yeah. No, I was part of it.
Yeah. Right, of course.
And I wouldn't have gotten to have been in Black Flag. I mean, there's so many things that would not be part of my reality sitting here as a man near 55 that are in my mind now.
Yep.
Like these bands who I love that I literally stood in front of, no barricade, elbows on the stage, looking up, going, wow, that's Gang of Four. That's the Buzzcocks. That's whatever band it was. And so that is the prime reason why I have no desire to be young, because I don't, and I'm not going to mention any band's names, but I wouldn't want that band to be my favorite band when I was 17.
Wow.
Yeah. And it always comes back to the music.
And you try not to also be like the crusty old guy who, you know, is saying, well, when I was a kid, I was out there watching the Buzzcocks.
Well, that's a thing, though. I mean, I have a little bit of that.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, I write for the LA Weekly. And I just wrote a thing last night into this morning kind of about that. I saw Dinosaur Jr. play seven nights in New York last week. And they were so good. It's one of my favorite bands. Mm-hmm. They did two sets. Set one is their first album because it's 30th anniversary and all of that. And it was amazing. Second set, new songs, you know, different songs with a lot of guests.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the guests are like old geezers like me. Bob Mould from Husker Du
sure.
came up there.
Oh, my God.
Tweety from Wilco. Kim Gordon, Sonic Youth. Me, I was up there.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, I was up there.
What song?
I did a song called Don't from the Bug album. Their third album. Anyway, Mike Watt of the Minutemen,
mm-hmm.
he's on stage. And then there's all these younger artists who are, you know, they're getting their thing going, they're 20-something, early 30s. And I noticed one thing down to the last performer. All the older ones, like Kim Gordon, 62 years old, and comes on stage and crushes it. Mm-hmm. Mike Watt, I thought the place was going to explode. Mm-hmm. Bob Mould, unbelievable amounts of energy, like 10 Mack trucks of TNT, this guy.
Yeah.
And I notice all the younger acts, the young bloods, they are really kind of casual. They kind of half learn the songs. And they, you know, they kind of trail off on one of the lyrics. Like, you didn't even finish the line. And they're just kind of like, yeah, you know. And I noticed their caloric burn down to the last person was a fraction of people 30 years older. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about it in the LA Weekly saying, you know, I didn't even put myself in it. I said, these people come. Mm-hmm. I said, maybe it was just me being an old man carping going back in my day. Mm-hmm. But they come from cold vans. Moist clubs where you walk in through your audience, loading your gear in because you're late because the snow. Play your show, 80 people there. It's rough. And if you can come through that and not go back to your job or back to your mom's, and if you can make it through that, you take the stage like you're going to chew it to pieces. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't been made to do that, you'll never get on stage with that kind of like
appetite.
Maybe ownership and that kind of like
drive
star time, like it happens now.
This is the biggest show I'm going to ever do.
Like that
mentality.
Yeah. I noticed that with all the old school people, like they just went up there and just ripped it, and all the younger people, they're fine, but it's just a different head they're in. It's a different bolt of cloth. You know, they have internet. It's just a different world they were raised up in, and communicate their music through. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm just saying the difference is profound. And I'm very glad I come from one and not the other. So I think the one that I'm from, the rougher bolt of cloth, has kept me in the game of it longer, just because you have to be tougher. I come from something that was not friendly, you know, not necessarily conducive to your next show. So you stuck it out in spite of your audience, in spite of everything. And so there's something to be said for the age you are now. And then there's someone like my mom and her gig memories. She goes, yeah, Coltrane, Miles. I'm like, I'm so jealous. And she used to see them separately and together. So it's like she was there for that. So everyone, and she probably would have no interest in seeing Led Zeppelin. Like, hey, but I got to see Zeppelin. She's like, great, you go have fun with that. Mm-hmm. I saw Monk. And so everyone might have their time, but I have no regrets for my age.
I'm 100% in agreement with you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are days, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But, so as you mentioned writing for the LA Weekly, and before we go into the film, He Never Died, which is the film.
Right.
And series, I believe.
Well,
how's that working? But I was going to come to that, but since I brought it up,
well, sure,
may as well respond to it.
The film is done. You've probably seen it.
I have.
Okay. Here's what the planners had planned, and that's Zach, the producer, and Jason, the writer, creator, director. They wanted to make the film, which they did, for it to be basically a pilot. The longer version of the whole thing as it turns into a TV show.
Right.
Jason has already written a season. Mm-hmm. I've read a couple of episodes. It is completely unhinged in the most wonderful way.
It's pretty unhinged.
I know, but he takes it. He has a wild mind.
Yeah.
He's a really sweet guy. He should have been here today. I wish you could have met him. You'd really like him.
Yeah.
He's just a great guy. Uh-huh. And just, he's a creative guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, the episodes are completely wild. And so they are pitching to all these agencies to see if they can get a TV show happening. So I don't know exactly the status of that, but they are going for it really hard.
Right.
So they have a pilot, He Never Died. They have the show written for a season, you know, in basic rough draft.
Sure.
And they have a cast. I mean, they have me if they want me. I don't, you know, I guess I would be the guy again. So that is the basic 500-year war plan of the thing, is that it's a TV show.
Yeah, and you're ready to commit to something that would be potentially go on for –
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd love it because I really like the character. I like Jason. I just like where he's just an interesting guy. Good man.
I can tell.
And he's a very creative person. And he and I get along very well. We work, we really cook together. Mm-hmm. Zach, the producer, is a good man. honest, and he and I get along. So it would be a good thing.
Right.
And I've never had a steady job. For 35 years, I've kind of swung from vine to vine and have been extraordinarily lucky. Every year, I've never been unemployed. I go from movie to tour to this to that, and I reach out my hand and a vine swings into it, and I can keep on going through the jungle. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I've been extraordinarily lucky. But when I was on Sons of Anarchy, it was 6 months of, here's your job, show up every day, work, mm-hmm. and go home. It was kind of cool having a little bit of stability. And of course, at the end of the season, I get killed off because I'm a bad person. But I must say, I had a great deal of envy as I left the set, knowing that whole cast, that show is going to, it was the only second season, but knew it was going to be just fine, that it was going to go from strength to strength, which it did. And all of those guys, unless their character gets killed in some huge thing, that most of those, that cast has a job next year, the year after, where they can go like, yep, in April, I'm back with the gang. And I thought to myself, wow, that might be cool to have one of those one day for like 3 years or something. And so, long story short, if He Never Died turned out to be something like that, I would not hesitate. It's a vehicle I would love to get back in.
Right.
And if it got 10 miles down the road, I would be that much happier. As it is now, those two have done the legwork. They've worked so hard. And we'll see if anyone, you know, bites at the hook.
I actually had Michael Imperioli on the show from The Sopranos, you remember, and Spider and Goodfellas.
Yep.
And he was saying, you know, I mean, of course, Sopranos ran for however many seasons, six or however.
Yep.
But he was like, look, you know, one season for an actor is a great opportunity because it's a year of steady work for, you know. I hope that comes to be. It's such a funny show. It's a really funny I don't know. I haven't. I've seen you in a number of things as an actor, of course, but I don't remember you playing something quite so deadpan. Like this was.
But that's Jack.
Yeah, right. The character you play is named Jack. Yeah. He's there's a slow burn to the story itself. It's like, what am I watching? There's like these explosions of action of story, kind of just all of a sudden.
And Jack reads everything. Like, just to make everyone aware, Jack has been alive for hundreds of years. Why? Well, go see the movie and find out. It's no fun to get that spoiled.
Yeah, and I did want to ask you at the top about that, but I figure I'll let you kind of you navigate about that.
Jack has been alive for hundreds of years, and you and I and anyone listening, to a certain degree, sculpts their lives with an end date in mind. 10 places to see before you die. We read that headline on all kinds of ads. We don't think of the die part. You just go, oh, that's built into the, but I'm not going to die. Well, I will, but I'm not even thinking about it. It's real, but not me. But yes, but not now. And so we attach our mortal urgency to everything we do. Like, you know, you're the young guy at the dance, or are you going to go over and ask a little girl to dance? Like, now or never, pal. Life's short. You better get over there. What if we took that off the table? What if we said eternity is yours? For a moment, you might go, cool, I can live forever? Oh, boy.
Right.
Get back to me in 500 years and tell me how that's working out for you.
Get back to me in 500 years.
Yeah, or get back to me in one afternoon in traffic where you're like, I hate people. Do that same drive for 700 years and tell me how much you're loving life. Jack is in a 24/7 existential crisis. He's bored. He's clinically depressed. He's so done, and he can't get out for the reasons that you discover later. And so
– there's no imperatives. Is that
– I'm sorry?
There's no, like, imperative. There's no –
to do anything.
Yeah.
And when we meet Jack in the film, he has dialed in his life to the lowest possible pulse. He lives on flesh, and so for centuries he's killed. But now he pays off young interns who are broke med students who will sell anything for a dollar. He buys bags of blood that they steal from the hospital. Eventually, that guy becomes a doctor. But guess what? There's four new med students always looking for an easy buck. So he doesn't have to kill anyone to sustain himself. He lives alone in an apartment, lives in his underwear, sleeps 15 hours a day, watches bad television, a lot of naps. He's just trying to get through life because there's what ambition would you have? This is hundreds of years of finding the way to forget he's alive. Mm-hmm. That's when we meet Jack. And then sadly for Jack, his world is tossed upside down when he discovers he has a 19-year-old daughter from some dalliance in his past. And he has angered some low-level mafia types that he used to work for. His daughter gets kidnapped. He meets the daughter briefly. She gets kidnapped as revenge against him. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden he realizes, it's not her fault she's kidnapped. I must do the right thing. So Jack is about 99% awful. He's a damn monster. There's no redeeming qualities. However, 1% of Jack says, I have to rescue this human. That is...
He has a code. I mean...
Yeah.
I think
he's not a dishonest person. Is this he's broken. He's smashed to pieces. He's powderized. But he has enough. That 1% that is analog, that has a pulse, realizes, my daughter's in danger. She didn't deserve that. It's not right. Mm-hmm. I have to right the wrong. The same time, he meets the waitress, his daily journey for his vegetarian meal. She takes an odd fancy to him out of boredom, maybe. Maybe he's the one nice guy who comes in every day. Maybe he tips well. And her life is super depressing. She's overqualified for her job. And there's this odd guy who's not rude, mm-hmm. who's kind of mysterious, me, Jack. And you find out by watching the film, the two most sane, heroic, and brave people in the entire film are the two women, our two female leads. And they're brilliant, both of them, as actresses and as characters and as people. They're just fantastic. Jack is somewhat humanized and snapped into action to do something remotely good by how he is steered by the actions and situations of the two women. On his own, he's not exactly a sociopath, because that takes calories. Mm-hmm. He's just trying to get through life without having to deal with you or anybody. Mm-hmm. And if he just can grunt at the waitress once a day, go to bingo, and he goes to bingo out of sheer boredom and distraction. He can get out of his apartment, which feels like a cage, and go to bingo and be around people, pass for normal. The reason he likes bingo is because he is attracted to human flesh, but not elderly, because mm-hmm. the flesh is old and it's full of medicine.
So he's just avoiding, he's interacting, but he's avoiding temptation.
Because he talks about his sobriety at the end of the film in one scene, mm-hmm. and he's talking to one guy, and he said, you and your actions basically knocked me off the wagon. I was doing really good for a while, but here we are.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna eat you. Because he's been knocked off the wagon by this bad guy. Otherwise, there's bags of blood, no one died.
Yeah.
And he's living as good a life as this ghoul can live.
It's an interesting thing as you talk about it, because not only, I mean, he's lived for, historically, we're not going to say how far, but pretty damn far back.
A long time.
And he's going to be around for a real long time. So it's an interesting thing. Because there's one funny line where I think your daughter, the character of your daughter, by the way, you have great chemistry. She's terrific. And
yeah,
you guys together are very funny. Where she basically asks you, maybe it was her, or it might have been the waitress, asks you about the Civil War.
That was the waitress.
That was. It was the waitress at the coffee shop, and you're basically, yeah, I was in China. It was in China then.
Now, you want to know the backstory on that? It's really fun.
Sure. Yeah.
I asked Jason.
Have all the backstory.
Yes.
I asked
every possible question about the character. I had 11 months to prepare, and Jason said, "Hey, if you want to rewrite anything, if you get into this and you find there's something non-Jack about what you're saying, let's talk about it. Like, let's like really detail this." And that's how I like to work with people. I like to work very intensely and very collaboratively when I'm allowed. Uh-huh. Some directors, like, here's your script, shut up and act. They don't want to know what your big idea
process is.
And that's fine. Mm-hmm. Jason was quite different. He said, I really want to know what you think. If you have any ideas of if Jack would never say this, tell me. Let's work. I said, great. So at one point, I said, okay, here's a scene where the waitress asks Jack, what was the Civil War like, now that she understands what he is and believes it? And he says, I don't know. I was in China. So I said, why was I in China? And he says, you remember the serial killer Albert Fish? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah. You know, I think they electrocuted him eventually. Mm-hmm. He's a total ghoul, a killer. In the 1860s, I think it was, he was in China. It was Jack. Mm-hmm. Jack was Albert Fish.
I see.
And that's what kept him away from the Civil War, because uh-huh. he was in China killing. I think he's killing kids. And so Jack's a monster. He's not your friend.
Yeah.
And there's so many mini moments like that where you probably would have to ask the director. For the viewer, they hear that line, they're like, okay, he was in China, whatever. Right. Me being the guy who has to say that, I want to say it with, I don't want to say, why am I saying that?
With some weight to it.
My body and my face will show I don't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So that's why I always ask. Huh. I go, so wait a minute, I have a daughter, which means I like women. So what, was this woman my girlfriend? Mm-hmm. Or just help me out with this. He goes, yeah, you've had relationships. I mean, you are somewhat mortal. I mean, you have a kid.
Right. So, and with the waitress, for instance, there is obviously
there's a moment.
Yeah.
And you see the two of us, we, you know, I drop her off at a place like, you know, kind of a guy would do on an mm-hmm. odd date. And we're leaning in for the kiss and she's kind of hoping it's going to happen. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I see where this can go. It can only go one way. I eventually tear her arm off and eat her alive.
Yeah.
And that can't, I can't, that's she's nice. I can't do that. Yeah. So I just bolt. I don't even go, well, see, I about face and run because I'm losing control.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So is the film opening this Friday?
The film opens on Friday. The
18th. Very good.
Yeah. Here in New York. You know, in kind of like limited releases.
Sure. As an indie limited film theatrical. Does. Right. Yeah. Of course, nowadays. But, you know, it's also, I'm sure, right? It's also going to be available on digital platforms.
Yep. Video on demand. And I think it's going to be a Netflix thing eventually. Mm-hmm. I mean, the producer people work very hard on getting this thing everywhere.
Right.
It being what it is.
I hope that it has the opportunity for the series to take place. That would be pretty fun to watch.
I've been to the film three times, and I rarely watch myself in a movie. I like making them. I don't like watching them. And so I've seen He Never Died three times with a theater audience that didn't know I was there. I kind of crept in.
Yeah, sure, of course.
And to watch people laugh at the funny parts and cheer, which is odd. This guy gets his throat ripped out. Hooray, it's a horror fan. What are you going to do?
That's what happens.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
But when we did something in the film...
It's not a documentary.
Right. So
that's good.
When something happens in the film that is funny, like someone yells at Jack and he just goes, uh-huh. He's just like deadpan. Yeah. It is funny. When you hear the audience laugh, you go, oh, they get it. They're with us. Mm-hmm. We're not leaving them in some kind of dust.
Right, and I'm sure that's a very sensitive, you must be worried about or at least concerned about like that. Like how do you make this guy still... you want people to root for him. You have to. In other words, even if he's like Tony Soprano. I mentioned The Sopranos earlier.
Right.
He was a monster.
Yeah.
But he was also a dad. And was another of things.
And you don't want him to go to jail. You don't want him to get
human.
Killed.
No.
Oh, you want him to live for 10 more seasons. I hate when that show is over. Yeah, I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
But there are bad guys you root for. I mean, it always happens because they have some redeemable qualities or they – do their thing so well, like a guy like Dexter. I was sad that series ended. I wish it was.
They really mastered that. The same side of the issue where you master this thing, but how do you keep it right on the line there? The tension between making him a monster, but also we can relate on some level.
Sure,
it's
or
creepy.
Like Walter White. Who wanted Breaking Bad to be over? No one. Yeah. I mean, like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
But he was a drug dealer. He destroyed lives.
Oh,
yeah, you want him. You don't want him to go to jail. You don't want Hank to get him. You want it to work out because essentially he's good. Jack screwed up, and you find out his big mistake, and he's paying for it, not for the rest of his life, for eternity, and he's done. but he's not. You know what I mean? He's done, but his done keeps on happening, and so. There's a lot of, you know, what attracted me to the script when I read it is I laughed at all the funny parts. I read it backstage at a venue here in New York. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, funny, that's funny, that's funny. And I saw if I did that, I would do it this way. The next day I met Zach and Jason. And I said, it's funny, right? Or am I rude to think it's funny? They go, no, you got it. It is funny. And I go, it's funny all the time. They go, exactly.
Yes, and it is.
And it is. And so I was happy when I saw the audience nailing those parts of it.
Well, again, the movie's called He Never Died, and it stars Henry Rollins, and good luck with that film.
Thank you.
And everything after. And also, you say you write it regularly for the LA Weekly, so people can check out your articles. They're probably
available. All you need to do is just type in Henry Rollins or Rollins LA Weekly, and they'll go right to the website, and every article I've done, which is like 5 years worth, is posted for free viewing and reading and download.
And is it what topics are you writing about? Is it kind of personal?
I'm in the music section, and for the first couple of years, I wrote about music. And they one day they told me and they said, "Oh, by the way, you can write about anything you want." Yeah. I'm like, "Oh," And so I write a lot about music, but then sometimes it's not about music because I travel a lot. So right. 2 weeks ago, I wrote about Antarctica because I just came from there.
No way, really?
And yes, it was stunning. And so a lot of times I write about, I don't know, something that just happened, or when someone I know has passed away, I'll mm-hmm. write a thing about how I remember him. Okay. And so
and that happens way too frequently.
Mm-hmm. I owe 1,000 words a week to the weekly, and it's wow. it's nice having an editor. It's a good discipline. Like yeah. I have a deadline. Damn it.
Yeah. And well, it's you seem fun. To like the structure sometimes because you've been without a lot of it, or you've had to self create your own structure.
Yeah.
It's nice to have it sometimes put on you by
absolutely.
Someone
I like having an editor. I yeah. like I like owing a column. It and writing for the LA Weekly for the last several years has, you know, I do a lot of writing. I own a publishing company.
Yeah, I do know. I got your collected works or the reader, mm-hmm. the Henry Rollins reader, yep. and like an idiot forgot to bring it, but oh, I well, thought it would.
Next time.
Yeah.
But I do my own writing. But when you write for someone else, when someone is like, you know, don't be late, you owe a column. It's made me a much better writer because you just have to just really turn it around
sure.
and you learn, you get your sentence structure way more together because you're forced to just go turn it out. And it's a challenge. In some weeks, I got nothing to write about. And I really have to squeeze my brain. So it's a fun challenge.
Well, I like those weeks because that means somebody didn't just die, or maybe there's no Trump headline or something like that. Yes. Thanks so much. It was really great meeting you.
Very, very good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Got room for one more? They call him the hangman. When the handbill says dead or alive, the rest of us just shoot you in the back, come up on top of a perch somewhere, and bring you in dead over a saddle. But when John Roof the hangman catches you, you hang.
Get in, boys!
This here is Daisy Domergue. She's wanted dead or alive for murder. When that sun comes out, I'm taking this woman to hang. Is there anybody here committed to stopping me from doing that?
Well, well, well. Looks like Minnie's haberdashery is about to get cozy for the next few days.
And that is the final clip I'm going to play today. And then that, of course, is from The Hateful Eight, the new Tarantino film. Now, that, too, has been getting a lot of articles written about it. But I can just say that most of the people that I've seen have seen the film enjoyed it thoroughly. It's a long movie. So I think it's going to put off quite a few people from seeing it just because it times in at about 3 hours. But it's funny and it's outrageous and, of course, very entertaining film, regardless of what you may think. And you know, on some level, it really does touch upon the issues of race in a very, very visceral level at this point, where the issues that we're dealing now with racial tensions that exist in this country, the film actually is very pertinent. It's worth seeing and having a conversation about, I think. And again, for anybody who loves Tarantino, this is the quintessential Tarantino film. It hits every mark. And even a number of the actors in the film have been in, of course, other Tarantino films like Tim Roth and Samuel L. Jackson. So that's The Hateful Eight. The only other movie I'm going to see this weekend, because I kept missing it at every opportunity I've had to see it, is Spotlight. I'm really looking forward to that. And one of my past guests, Neil Huff, is in that movie, so I'm really looking forward to seeing it, hopefully this weekend. So this weekend I doubt I'll get to see Star Wars, but I will see The Hateful Eight, I will see Chirac, and I will see Spotlight. Okay, well, let's get into my conversation with Denari Braxton and Takeshi Fukunaga. We're talking about their film, Out of My Hand.
This is my cousin I told you about, Cisco. Welcome to New York. Where are we going, sir?
How's work been?
Great.
No problems driving?
No, you can get in with a dog.
Oh, come on, man. I just need to go through a park.
Well, driving is the easy part. You are from Liberia, sir?
I have family there.
I'm from there, too.
So how'd you make out back there?
I used to be a tapper on the rubber plantation. It was very, very hard work. We found a way.
I miss it sometimes, you know.
We work too hard. We struggle too long. We have the ginger to tell.
Hey, my name is Dondari Braxton. I'm speaking into a red microphone. I'm holding at a 45-degree angle.
Good, yeah. You're holding it exactly right. Oh, and thank you for putting me in touch with Tlaine. Thanks for putting me in touch with Tlaine. And over at Array, she said so far they didn't have a plan to send anybody down to South By, so I got to kind of go back to the drawing board and try to drum up a couple more people for that panel.
Who right now? There was somebody that you said was...
I have Tim League, who's the CEO of Draft House Films, you know, Alamos Draft House and Fantastic Fest, and then I also have Scott Glosserman, who's the CEO of Gather, which is like a crowd-sourced screening.
I don't even know about
company.
That,
well, have you heard of Tug? There are these companies that where you basically, if you're let's say a filmmaker, or let's say you're like you just want to put, let's say you have a theater and you want to put together a screening, you can use them. They'll come in and they'll, you know, supply the, make the screening happen. But you have to just maybe show you have enough people to warrant that.
Look, I'm for crowdsourced everything. It definitely defines the DIY kind of generation. It makes sense to me. And as it gets harder and harder to find more traditional theatrical settings.
And now, but now they're also getting into sort of doing a little bit like kind of what Array was doing by your description, which it was to maybe do a couple of traditional theatricals, but then do one-offs. And that, you know, they can do that, whereas a lot of distributors or exhibitors can't really do that. They want a week, and it has to be a week. But if you know, we know that that's not always the most it doesn't make sense to have a theater empty for a week, you know, 5 days or 6 days, just so you can have an opening night, you know. So, but they still do, I guess, the week for qualifying for whatever. So, yeah, you know. But even that, I think, is kind of, maybe they need to rethink that even.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of these guys are doing, like, week theatricals just because of that kind of puts them on this legitimizing plateau. So when you do the SVOD or the AVOD, then people know it as the film that, you know, had the 1 week at IFC, so therefore it's an actual movie or whatever.
Right,
you know,
yeah. And I
trying to meet those expectations.
And I think because when there's as many... We'll just finish this thought, and then we'll do an actual formal introduction. But I think because there's so many films now, there's such a so many independent films and studio films coming out that there must be a way to figure out what are the films that are well made and that have a certain level of quality and that have legs and that can. So if we say, well, at least if they are getting theatricals and some distribution, this is what we mean by distribution. It has this. Does this, that, and the other. Right. Then we know that, okay, this film obviously has gone through a certain QA, quality assurance. And so, you know, otherwise any film, it would be mixed with every other film. So I don't know if your film, which is out of my hand, if a 7 day even in New York is really serves the film, maybe a nice long weekend with, you know, where you can pack the screenings with us, you know, community with the fun Q&As and getting people to talk. But is it maybe the theaters are very idle during the week?
Well, it's interesting what you're saying too, because there's a weird kind of dichotomy, this ironic dichotomy between people are still looking for films to go through the traditional channels, like, okay, that was an IFC, and we know that it's gone through that quality control that you just talked about, and we know it's a real movie, versus the fact that people don't want to go to the movie theaters anymore and watch these kinds of films. You know? So there's still the same pressures to go through those traditional channels, but there's not enough market value, so to speak, for these theaters to want to program the film. So we're in this weird kind of nexus between those two different places. Yeah. For us, I mean, maybe Takeshi, you want to speak on that? The plan in terms of our theatrical, I think you probably spoke with them a little bit more than I did on that subject.
We're talking, by the way, with Dondari Braxton, Takeshi Fukunaga. Did I get that right? Fukunaga? Who are the co-directors of Out of My Hand, which is a new, relatively new feature.
Except we're actually co-writers.
Okay. Oh, that's right. I do recall now that you mention it because, all right. Takeshi, you're the director of the film. Inari is a producer, but you co-wrote it. Got it. And do you want to speak on maybe just your thoughts on distribution? You guys had the advantage of having a conventional theatrical in New York.
Well, I don't know if I have anything to add from what you mm-hmm. guys already talked about, but I mean, I do agree with what you're saying about, like, it doesn't really make sense to have, you know, an empty theater for a week, you know, at like a, you know, cities, like different cities throughout the state. But instead of doing that, like, I think Array's approach with this release, that how to, over like having a one-offs and then like a, and then make it as an event, mm-hmm. you know, and then try to, I guess like a, and then like a, you know, bringing me at, for the Q&A and then like,
right,
yeah, and yeah. Then, so that really worked for especially a movie like ours, you know, mm-hmm. that has like no-name stars and you know doesn't really have any, I guess, commercial or marketable points on paper. So the model they had, you know, for our release, you know, really made a sense for the kind of movie we have.
Yeah,
and I'm you know we're pretty happy with you know what they did, and then like, and then after we finished the U.S. release, you know they are planning to have a couple of months to arrange screenings in cities in Europe and Africa. So I'm very excited for that as well.
That is great.
I mean, one thing that like Takeshi and I both realize is, despite being
talk closer to the mic,
despite having this great. Kind of, I guess you'd call it press machine because you have Ava behind it. And
oh, yeah.
You had Takeshi going on HuffPost, on Good Morning, Good Day New York, whatever it's called, and lots of articles all over the place and really great stuff happening. Uh-huh. And Ava being super hands-on about it. It's still really hard to get that theater
sure.
full.
It is well, it's hard. Also the subject matter. You want to give a little synopsis of the film while we're at it?
So, yeah, it's about a struggling Liberian rubber plantation worker moves to New York and becomes a cab driver in hopes to find a better life, mm-hmm. and then but then once he comes to New York, you know there are all different sorts of challenges he has to face, and sure. then he and ends up meeting with his old friend who puts him to confront with his difficult past.
Yeah, it has a little bit of a neo-realist streak to the film. I remember when we were talking about it. Another interesting thing that we were talking about on BK Live, the TV thing that Denari. We did is that you guys shot the first half of the film, yeah. which takes place in Liberia. For the second part of the film takes place, as Takeshi just mentioned, in New York. You had to raise money for that, so you did a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for this financing the second part of the production.
Yeah, we went for broke, so to speak, because
yeah.
we had actually originally we were planning a little bit of a longer pre-production. Process. And Takeshi was the first person to leave for Liberia. Mm-hmm. And originally he had left thinking that he was going to cast the movie there and come back. But what happened was he made contact with a new organization in Liberia called the Liberian Movie Union. Or actually it's called the Liberia Movie Union. And it's a new arm of the government that's launched basically to encourage film to foster like a positive imagery of and a new image of the Liberian people, because it's really just a place that's been pretty plagued with brutal wartime imagery. That's really the yeah. only way that you see Liberia outside of Liberia. You know,
yeah.
you see the Vice Guide to Liberia that has General Butt Naked in it, and those are all extremely important bits of information, because there's not a lot of conversation about Liberia either.
But there's also General Butt Naked, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But there's also not, you can't find a lot of media or art or film about just life in Liberia and the Liberian people. So they encourage that, and I think that's why they...
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, and they responded very positively to the script, because it wasn't about violence.
Are they vetting the project to that degree to make sure that Liberia is, in fact... being presented in a positive fashion?
I can't speak to the degree that they're vetting. I don't know what other kind of films they're involved in. I do know that when we were there, Warner Brothers was there putting some kind of documentary together.
Talking to the mic. Yeah.
But I think that was also supposed to be about the war. Yeah.
But just speaking from our own experience, they were really enthusiastic and super helpful, and they're really the ones on the ground that made it possible. After the Liberia port, to skip ahead very briefly, we brought 10 of the Liberian Movie Union
filmmakers here to work in production on the New York part. So the relationship was very intense and added a lot of magic, I think, to the process of the shoot, for sure. Yeah.
Is it the, what was going on, the conflicts in Liberia, were they civil wars or like, you know, the typical more rebel fraction against the government fraction, and then either both kind of end up corrupt on some level?
It's a long succession of civil wars. I mean, it's sectarian, mm-hmm. and it has been tribal.
Yeah.
But of course, it's been primarily responses to leadership. For example, a lot of people know the name Charles Taylor. He's one of the more known names on the subject of Liberia, and of course, a lot of the bloodshed was about ousting him.
Mm-hmm.
That time. And so, you know, everybody that is in Liberia who's basically above the age of, let's say, 20, mm-hmm. has had some relationship to the war. Maybe, Takeshi, you can talk about, like, Bishop, for example.
You mean his personal story?
Yeah,
he...
Who's Bishop?
Bishop is a main actor.
Okay, that's Bishop. He plays
Cisco in the movie, and he was actually working in the rubber plantation during the war, way up in the north, or somewhere in the countryside, you know. And that was how he was surviving, you know, through the war. And then after that, he went to a refugee camp in Ghana, and that's where he actually started acting. And with other Liberian theater group, and in the refugee camp.
Wow.
So we never wanted to make a movie about the war or the violence or any kind of a negative portrayal of the people in Liberia. But at the same time, you know, civil war, the history of civil war is so, you know, huge in modern, you know, Liberian, you know, history and society. So we had to include it in some way, and then that's how we, you know, one of the, you know, the reasons why we chose to work with, you know, General Butnick in the movie, and then, you know, how we kind of put some elements, you know, that had to do with that particular history.
Yeah, I mean, Cisco, again, the main character, goes to the United States, but his own personal history follows him.
Right,
because of his own involvement, the character's involvement in war crimes.
For sure. There's an element in the story where the character comes to New York, and there's an element of the ghosts from your past haunting him, and him not being able to escape so easily from the world that he comes from, and the things that he may or may not have done that the film doesn't answer in the film.
So you made the film, and where did you premiere it when you were finished? Where was the festival premiere again?
So the film premiered at the 65th, I think, Berlin International Film Festival in the Panorama section.
Okay. Is that where Ava found you or somebody
No,
from
it's not,
company?
Actually. So even before that, speaking of Dan Schoenbrum from IFP, the first thing that the film got into was the IFP marketing distribution
labs,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
which was a huge deal for us, and that's where Takeshi and I really kind of got a kick in the butt and realized it's 20 guys in a room, 20 guys and girls in a room that mm-hmm. don't think they know everything about filmmaking, and you realize that you don't know anything about what to do after a film. After, we learned a lot there. That was highly educational. They really helped us situate ourselves after finishing the film and position ourselves for the festival cycle,
mm-hmm.
and they made the whole thing possible. So we did get into Berlin. We premiered in Panorama. Thereafter, the U.S. premiere was the Los Angeles Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
And the film won that festival. It was the Grand Jury Prize.
Uh-huh.
And that is where Tulane and latterly Ava first saw the movie.
That must have been exciting. Takashi nods his head. Yes. It's okay.
That is Takeshi's excited face.
Takeshi, do you rap? You want to rap?
He does Japanese rap, actually.
Nope.
That's honest. Or maybe it's not honest.
You don't have to do that. I put you on the spot. So that must have been a very exciting thing when you're approached by that. It's like what a unique organization. And as being first on the list, you know you're going to be part of that initial burst of publicity and for this new venture, right?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing, the amazing thing about them is that they didn't even contact us through, we weren't even contacted, that didn't even go through sales, our sales agent. That went, they came directly to us. About having seen the film and about wanting to potentially distribute it, so they're just.
And then the salespeople must, the sales company must have been then want to know and be included.
Yes, but we don't have too much comment about that.
Yeah, well, that's another issue, isn't it? But we don't have to talk about it right now. But it is another issue. The salesperson, this other component of the process, which maybe is. Also, again, to get back to my original rant, because usually we are continuing to retrofit our films or whatever it is. It doesn't even have to be a film. It could be anything to fit the conventions because, you know, the conventions are usually run by big corporations like, you know, megaplexes and big distribution companies. And so these sales agents, for instance, are usually, you know, that's where the money's at. And that's where they're going to want to, that's where they're going to want to go. And if you're trying to do something creative and different, they're going to advise you otherwise or kind of disappear.
Yeah, I mean, Takeshi and I are new. You know, this is our first feature film. So we are the first to say that we have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
But, you know, in our experience, for sure, in seeing all of the different ways that, I mean, for us, it's been very interesting to watch our IFP lab mates. In that lab, there was Chloe Zhao's and Molly Asher's Songs My Brother Taught Me. There was Charles and Clara Pokal's Christmas Again. Embers, that's by Charles Spano and Claire Carré's Embers. And so there's a lot of really, and then there's a bunch of other films that were really great too. And they're all doing these wonderful things in different parts and different festivals and having different distribution, so let's say, luck or different distribution strategy. I mean, it's everybody wants to have traditional distribution at the end of the day. Everybody wants to have their, they want to be in the theaters, they want to go on iTunes and Netflix and have their day and they had SVOD or whatever kind of release.
But let's say somebody did go to you and say, you know, you can qualify for this for this award and that international distribution and this and that if you do a long weekend, and we're going to pack every, you know, screening with, you know, people for your Q&A. I mean, you'd probably be happy with that because, you know, we know that, again, for most films, even bigger film titles that have lots of distribution money, that they're still sitting mostly empty for, not completely empty, I suppose. And what are you going to do with those rooms? You know, it's not like I'm not sympathetic, but, you know, what are we doing? Serving, who are we serving? The audiences? Are we serving the filmmakers? Are we serving theater?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the big questions, right? It's like, we're all angry, or as independent filmmakers making very low budget weird movies or whatever we're making, we're not angry, but we're all like, come on, distributors, like, put our stuff out there with X-Men and whatever else. And but of course it's not very difficult to understand the position from the other perspective, just the simple fact of the matter that there's not money there and that the theaters don't get full.
I guess one thing I can say from our experience is like during the IFP lab, you know, like we had someone, you know, come into the room as a guest and then told us that our movie had the least commercial value in the amongst all the other projects in the lab. And then after that,
Less than Christmas Again.
The least. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, what can I say? But then after that, you know, we got into Berlin, but that was kind of like in the, from that acceptance, we started, you know, contacting to all the other, you know, sales company, and then but it was either too last minute, you know, that they had too many movies on this, you know, on their catalog, or they just didn't see any, I guess, like a
potential
to sell.
Yeah.
And so those experience really was, disappointment. And for us, you know, after,
yes,
you know, like, because we were, I guess, like, you know, I guess, like, maybe ignorant enough to think that, you know, like, all you have to do is make a good movie and then get into a big festival and then everything else, you know, it's going to be or like after that.
What's the Netflix film though that they made? The Beasts of No Nation. Yeah. That does not. That has no more commercial potential. I don't think that has any commercial potential, and I'm not sure why they. Except for awards, I'm not certain why they're.
That one is a little different, though.
There's a movie star in it.
Yeah, movie star in it, and the
director. There's one movie star, but.
Yeah, but then the director. The director has already.
Fukunaga. Fukunaga. Mm-hmm. So, he has the same name as you.
Last name, yeah, but I'm not related. The same.
Maybe you should have left it open.
It's too late now.
Oh well.
But anyway, but no, what I was going to say is that so after all those kind of disappointing experience, we were super excited and then, you know, became hopeful after, you know, like how LA picked it up and then they put it out. So like,
oh, right.
Yeah.
So. Well, because, let me ask you this, Takeshi, since you're with the mic now, can you, especially going into your first go around, your first with the film, do you feel like, that there was a festival, the festival seemed to be receptive to the film. You got into very prestigious festivals, like the Berlin is number two, but right, maybe or three right behind Cannes. And then you have, LA, which is up in the top, I'd say four or five festivals in the country, prestige wise, right? So, and then Ray comes, which is exciting. Maybe one of the top filmmakers is championing your film. And all that is not in any way representative of the next phase. It's like, right? Is it kind of, it can be kind of crushing to a first time filmmaker.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm not saying you should be crushed because I think once you get past that disappointment, or you restart to really get down there and think, well, we have to get down in the trenches and figure it out.
Yeah, we definitely had this like a period of that, like, you know, like being crushed by all those like by the gap, you know, between what we want and what the market is demanding, you know, and then. But after all, you know, like we are, you know, proud to say we made a good movie, and then like a festival responded to that, and so was RA, and you know, like it might not be the huge, you know, release or anything, but you know, we are very, very happy with, you know, the kind of release RA is doing, and then, you know, the challenge is to meet like a happy, you know, middle between, you know, what we really want and then what maybe what, you know, market or industry is, you know, is, you know, want, you know, but at the core we know that, you know, the making a good movie is still the most important thing, and then once you figure it out and then put it out some way, it's gonna have its own life.
So I guess you try to, maybe the next one you'll have to cast somebody with a little.
If you know any A-listers, we're accepting all offers.
Okay, I just got an email from Elizabeth Moss. She's looking for something, and she keeps bothering me. You must know something.
That's so annoying of her. Yeah, if she's that desperate.
I just watched.
Find some role for her. In our next Liberia feature.
Yeah, I just watched something the other day. She had a 2-minute role in it. She was like in it for a second, and then she was gone.
Well, look, this is what everybody says, man. You gotta have the name talent if you want to get the money, if you want to get if you want to get the tickets sold. You gotta.
But they all start in some small independent film. Well, those before they become name talent. Idris Elba was, you know, doing probably small roles and little things for a while before he got The Wire.
I'm still hoping that. Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't even have entirely ironed out my own relationship to like the name talent thing.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm interested in working with great actors, no matter what level they are. And of course, I'm interested more superficially in working with actors who can help better serve the platform of a film.
Well, I've firsthand now witnessed a bunch of these rising Brooklyn indie low-budge filmmakers, and many of them have been on the show. And I'm watching them now.
You did a show with Kentucker, right?
That's right. And oh, yeah, I did do a I'd like to get him back on because I know he's making something new. But, you know, I'm talking about, like, Dustin DeFay and Orner, my friend Orner DeKell, and all these people Sophia Tikal that have been on the show since it started, and they all were making films with not well-known actors, but they are now two or three films further along in filmmaking, and they're now working with casting directors, and it's some of them have moved to LA, it's that kind of thing, and where I've seen this growth where they're now working with big crews. I just was at the set of the guy who made Summer of Blood and Applesauce. He's now making a film called Catfight. I was there the other night, and
what, on set?
Yeah, I was in a party scene. But there was Anne Heche over there, and over there. Oh, look, over there is Alicia Silverstone, and over there is Sandra Oh. And so everybody's grappling with those same issues that you guys are, and you make your decisions, and then you live with them, and then maybe.
There's the problems in there somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where it is. But of course, you want to find the actors who best serve the purpose of the story. Best serve the story. But of course, you also want
audiences,
operators. Who can get the film watched, and you want to share your story.
You have to pay for it all, and then you want to make these things for a living, and there are all these other factors that weigh in on motivating.
Decisions. I just hope that I hope there continues to be some kind of balance between. Actors who are working on these Star Wars or whatever movies, and then also want the balance, and also want to feel connected to the independent film community. And right now, I still feel like there's some heart out here. There's still a community. There's still people that are, in the fight together. And that kind of, dare I say, kind of collective. Responsibility. Maybe I'm being a little over lofty about it, but I feel
it's like a social contract, almost
think that there is in some. There's definitely some fraternity and sorority kind of going around. I think things that's still out here that defines the independent film movement. Okay, I'm really being waxing poetic, but I like to believe.
Well, good way to end the film. Out of my hand is
it's once it it's finished it's
still oh so it's doing the it's oh doing, right it's
the
going
cycle.
The one-offs, and you're about to travel again with the film, right? Do a number of one-off appearances, or is that already nothing scheduled?
Well, you just did that Q&A up at Boston. That really beautiful theater. But we are traveling very soon for the Indie Spirit Awards.
Actually, there's going to be a Indie Spirit Award John Cassavetes nominee screening.
John Cassavetes, right? We were doing the show literally as the announcement was leaked.
It was a leak.
But there's going to be a screening at LACMA in late January, I believe.
In where?
LACMA, some like a modern museum.
Oh, very good. So if you're listening in LA, the Spirit Awards screenings, there's going to be one for. Out of my hand, and thank you, Denari Braxton, producer, co-writer, and Takashi Fukunaga, who is the director and co-writer of Out of My Hand.
It's our pleasure, man.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. We're going to have another episode coming up before the end of the year, maybe even a second one. I don't know yet, but that's how I operate. The next episode for sure has on the New York Times journalist, the carpetbagger. David Carr, who passed away a couple of years ago, was the carpetbagger for a long time, and then Kara Buckley took over. Or I think there might have been one other person in between, if I'm not mistaken. And now Kara Buckley holds that title. So we're going to find out more about that. But it's essentially somebody who kind of follows the entire Oscar and award season trajectory over the course of the year. And Kara Buckley is that person. And so we're going to have her on the next episode of the podcast, as well as a few other surprises coming up. So thank you for listening, everybody. This is your host, Adam Chartoff, Film Wax Radio, episode number 326 of the podcast. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.